Five Lives Rugby Union Daily.
Rugby Union Daily, Tuesday morning. It is Nations Pod time and we are up and running in Six Nations Match Week 3. Already we've hit the ground with a special look at the Calcutta Cup through the eyes of Scotland boss Gregor Townsend. 30 plus years of experience as a fan player assistant and head coach. So get that now if you haven't already. Loads more to come this week. We're inside the England camp with Ashi. Sarah's taking a look at the rivalry between Ireland and Wales. We're on the ground in Murrayfield and Dublin and beyond. But today is Nations Pod time. Gro is here. Tom is here. How are you, boys?
Very well, thank you.
Very good, gents.
So, Tom, we got a message in from Craig Wilson because last week we were on a fallow week, the Rugby Union Daily, along with the Six Nations. Where's the Nations Pod, CJ? I'm having withdrawals and having to chat to people when walking the dog now. I've gone to find Tom on Trigate on BBC Scotland's pod. He had to have your verdict.
That was so
there
good.
There you go. I'm just calming down from that. I've regained my composure, boys. You'd be delighted to hear.
Is Fed say you were touchy post-match?
I was. You see, when is a try? When is up, down, and when down is up? I mean, you know. We're asked to believe. I'm going into one again already, lads. I just need to roll back. Haven't even started and I'm getting excited.
We did the very exact thing as the listener did in BBC Wales. We just had to listen to BBC Scotland's post-match podcast and it did not disappoint, Tom.
It's just like when you're... All of the stuff is true. Oh, Scotland should have had the game in the bag. Yes. They could have gone wide with that last play. Yes. Didn't make most of their chances, absolutely. But the ball was down, you know.
And was it? Was it definitively down?
Well, here's the thing, right? I know you're just winding me up, right? But here is the thing. It doesn't matter what anyone in the stadium or watching on television says. The TMO says there's the ball on the ground. Nothing else matters.
That's the only important piece of audio for your mind. Yep. Everything, every other conversation is irrelevant. It's just that one clip.
The TMO says the ball is on the ground. At that point, it's a try, is it not?
I would say you cannot definitively say that ball is on the ground.
You don't have to. You don't have to.
Well, you sort of do when the referee...
No, you don't. You don't. There's this... It's inconclusive. You have to be conclusive. You don't. You have to have compelling evidence. Compelling is the word here, that the ball is down. Now, surely we can all agree that there's compelling evidence that was a try. Compelling does it.
We're risking raking up graves here.
Yes. Let's rake away.
But I think it's still a very valid conversation, not necessarily about... try or no try, it's been discussed. I think most people are in agreement. It was a try, and if not definitely a try, then almost certainly a try. Whether it met the threshold, that's what the TMO decided. It didn't quite. Scotland lost, but we do need to start there, I think, because, Tom, we need to know the state of mind the Scottish players are in and the Scottish management. Their fans may be looking forward to the Calcutta Cup, but still with this sense of grievance, no doubt, and still with this sense of it could be 2-2, and it could be an England home win away from 3-3 with Italy, and 4-4, and then suddenly you dream of, you know, songs in the street. It was nearly complete. It was nearly so sweet. But it's not. It's a defeat, however it happened. So how do they go into this week? Because clearly for you, as someone who follows Scottish rugby, it's very important to you. You want to see it prosper. It's still lingering. It's still hurting.
Yeah, and I hope it is still lingering, and I hope it is still hurting, because if it is, and I'm sure it is, I think you could, if you're the Scotland management, you could easily, very easily turn that into a positive. In fact, yes, they lost, but they
were... Is that not easier said than done?
I think they can play on that, Chris, of course.
Is it kind of... But could it also suck some energy from them, suck some, I don't know, the spring in their step, because they know they've lost. They know they've got to go to Dublin still. They know they're another defeat, and suddenly they're looking down the barrel of a 2 out of 5, potentially, if they lose this and then just been hitting Luton Dublin.
Steady, two out of five.
It's fine margins, Tom. You this game on Saturday. The bookies have it as Scotland a couple of points favourites, but I think if you ask a room of 100 people, there'll be a pretty fair split.
Yep.
It's how do they not think, well, that win and they're two and then Italy means they're going to have a 3 from 5 almost certainly. Now, it's just set them on a different path, potentially.
Well, it does, but these are professional sports people. And you use any bit of grievance, any bit of bitterness that you could possibly lay your hands on. That old Munster philosophy, it's not just Munster, but it's what I grew up on. Munster going out of their way to find grievance. Even some of the Munster players of old, their great teams, inventing slights and sticking them up in the dressing room, like inventing quotes from people, journalists and other people, just to get the dressing room into fever pitch. I don't think Scotland have to invent anything. The motivation is all there. They feel that they were robbed, right? And going in against England, even if they'd won, that's the motivation. But it's England, like. It's the Calcutta Cup. So they don't need any more motivation. But they have it. And you can be sure Gregor Townsend and all those coaches will be, and not that they will need to wind up the players about the sense of injustice. It'll be in them. And I suspect it will come out. Now, whether that comes out and manifests itself as a victory, I don't know. But they will not be lacking in motivation and fire and brimstone on the weekend.
So do you see, Tom, Scotland as favourites then?
I do, grow, yeah. Home record is good. They've won. They've won 3 in a row against England. They've won 4 of the last 6. Actually, I think that statistically that's incorrect. It's 5 out of 6. People forget the 38-all victory for Scotland in 2019. So they've had England's number for throughout the Gregor Townsend reign. Home crowd, I think they're a better team than England. They have to prove it again, but they've proven it in 2021, 2022, and 2023. So I think they're rightfully favourites. Again, I think it'll be very close. But I think Scotland, I would back Scotland to win.
Do you agree, Chris?
I said after the England-Wales game, we did our On the Whistle pod, I think this is a scratch game. I think it's a 50-50. Scotland, I just checked with one prominent bookmaker who have Scotland 3-point favourites. Now, of those last 3 wins, I'm not sure how many Scotland started as the favourites. I don't think they would have started as favourites in 2021 at Twickenham with 1983 and all that. An England team that had won the title in 20, that reached the World Cup final in 19, they wouldn't have started as favourites then. And I don't think they would have started favourites at Twickenham last year because it was Twickenham still. And I know they won in 21, but still, you know, it carries weight, as do all the home venues in the Six Nations. 2022, maybe they would have started narrow favourites. I can't quite remember. I think the challenge for Scotland is psychological as much as anything. I agree with Tom. Which sounds perverse because England reached the World Cup semi-final and we're a scrum away from the final, but it feels as if this Scotland team has a better body of work than this England team, which doesn't make too much sense. But that kind of ties into how England are still quite a perplexing team to make sense of. On the one hand, they don't look up to much at times and they lack fluency and their games always appear a bit stop-start, but they've won 9 of their last 10 games. That would have been 10 out of 10. If the South Africa game had gone just the other way, or if Stewart had kicked it long, tiniest, barest of margins to bastardize Ian Smith. So, yeah, I don't know where I'm going with it. I think it's a really, really tight one to call. And I think the psychological challenge for Scotland is being favourites with, as Gregor Townsend said on our pod this morning, both coaches probably trying to paint their team as the underdogs this week, but also trying to get over what happened against France and use it to their advantage rather than thinking, oh my God, we had France where we wanted them for so much of that game and still lost regardless of the circumstances of that defeat.
What do you think, girl?
Yeah, it's a tough one. Now, you both, I think you're convincing me, Tom, beyond Chris, just with the recent body of evidence, the amount of victories Scotland have had, they wouldn't be fearful of England. And the pressure to a certain degree is off them now, isn't it? And my repetitive concerns about the Scotland game, as has been noted in previous pods, is whether or not they can do it when the chips are down and when it really, really matters. And arguably right now, it doesn't matter anymore for the Scots.
It matters
in the old idea of pride and facing your fiercest rivals, but there's nothing on the line anymore, is there?
There is. That
they need to play for
the England game. That's on the line.
Triple crown.
Also, if
don't
they,
start me in a triple crown again.
No, I know. But come on, like, but if they win, gets that situation where if you lose a game, look, I'm a big believer the Grand Slam is everything, and a title on points difference is nowhere near as impressive as a slam, obviously. But you know, we can't have a situation where if you lose one game, the rest don't really count. I mean, that's
no,
still,
I didn't,
still
I didn't, I'm not making that. I'm not making that argument, but the argument of being clutch and winning Super Bowls and that idea that, you know, you have to win this do or die. And Scotland, by the nature of that defeat, can relax a little bit, I think.
I don't think they can. You don't relax when you've got a Calcutta Cup game. And also, theoretically, they could go to Dublin with 3 wins out of 4 and have a remote chance of winning a title. You know, I mean, remote, emphasis on the remote, because I don't see anyone laying a glove on Ireland. But that's to play for. It's like, it's just because they've lost to France doesn't mean their season is over. You know, as I've said on this pod a gazillion times, Scotland haven't won anything since 1999. So they'll take whatever they get. The Triple Crown, if it's get to the final week of the championship, something they've never done, with even a 1,000,000 to 1 chance of winning. They've never even had that. You know, so that's still to play for. This championship is still very much alive for Scotland.
And the players have come in this week, Tom? Oh, it's, you know, on Monday.
Yeah, but Blair Kinghorn is back in the squad. You'd expect him to go straight in at 15. Magnus Bradbury is an interesting one. There's a bit of a concern around Matt Fagerson. So Magnus Bradbury, who's been frozen out for the longest time, he's come in as well. Probably as cover for Fagerson if he doesn't make it. So Darcy Graham hasn't made it. They thought he would, but he hasn't, which is a bit of a blow, because he's got a very, very good try-scoring record against England. Kyle Steyn is back in as well. He had to withdraw the morning of the France game because his wife went into labour. So they're looking all right, Scotland.
Chris, I'm reading that Manu's in contention for England.
Yeah. So I think just to correct myself, I said England won 9 out of 10. They won 8 out of 9, so they won 6 out of 7 of the World Cup and then 2. England have a fascinating selection quandary now, because I was just come from England training. So Elangi's back in training and in contention. So is George Martin, who I think really came of age at the World Cup. You know, went toe-to-toe mm-hmm. with the box, agreed. Which is no mean feat.
Yeah, he was excellent.
Ollie Lawrence is back in contention. He was originally down as rehabbing last week. Now he is fully in contention, but a slight spanner thrown in the works today because he didn't come out to train on Monday. And the word from the camp was that he's just having his workload managed. But I'm sure, you know, in an ideal world, you'd want him flying into things on a Monday. I would be staggered if Borthwick does not try his best to get one of Tuilagi or Lawrence in his 23, quite possibly in his starting 15, just to give England more punch. And if George Martin comes back into the frame as well, maybe as that kind of back five of the scrum cover, if he sticks with the same back five with Chesham and Itoje and then Roots and Earl in the back row with Underhill, and then he could have Martin covering along with Cunningham South, there's suddenly a more powerful and more dynamic look to that England 23. Dingwall's a lovely player, but you know, I do remember when England went up to Murrayfield 2 years ago with Slade and Daly in the midfield, and they had injuries, but they still had someone like Mark Atkinson in the squad who you felt could have been trusted just to add a bit of punch. So England could well have a Tuilagi or a Lawrence in the 23 or in the starting 15 if they come through, which does, I think, give another dimension, even if you sometimes absolutely marvel at the way Manu is still trucking at his age with his injury record. So maybe Lawrence is more likely to be the guy who can come back from an injury and be ready for a Calcutta Cup. So, yeah, as much as there's some interesting Scotland calls, some really intriguing England calls, England have won 2 games without looking spectacular, but then can make some proactive changes, potentially, guys, just to give their team that added power that they're desperately going to need at a place like Murrayfield.
My curiosity with regards to England is the progress they will make over time and this game plan that they deploy. They've still been pretty conservative in this competition. It was interesting how very sensibly at halftime in the Wales game, they reverted back to type and they got the ball over the line. So as much as we all criticise sides for maybe not playing enough or for being flamboyant enough, the principal objective of any sporting team is to secure the victory. And England, again, and we spoke about this right at the start of the competition, this idea of winning back the Twickenham crowd, yada, yada, yada. Is their greatest chance of success still by not necessarily playing Fijian rugby?
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think it is. I think it is, Chris. I mean, if this is an open game, I think Scotland win it. We've just got too much firepower for England. If it becomes a battle, and I haven't checked the forecast yet, but if it becomes a battle, a kind of not quite the monsoon conditions of 2020, but if it's a grim old day, I think that helps England because they play risk-averse rugby. I know they're trying to break out of that a little bit, but as Gro says, they broke out of that against Italy a little bit, scored some tries, and then reverted to type, as I could see it anyway, later on in that game. Maybe they did the same against Wales. I think they're trying to wrestle with who they are and what they are, England.
They definitely are, but I wouldn't be too sucked in that England are trying to play this flamboyant style. I think they want to show they've got more to their game than perhaps they showed at the World Cup. But on the other hand, Borthwick will like nothing more than trying to tactically unpick a one-off opponent. A bit like, you know, it's you don't want to dwell on this South game because England lost the game, but they got a lot closer than people thought and had the box on the run for parts of that game at least. I would not be surprised if, as Tom says, England do play a lot of kicking at Murrayfield. George Ford against Finn Russell is a fascinating tactical battle. I think you're right. Tuipulotu, Van der Merwe, the big men in the Scotland back line, so they might need some punch of their own to try and combat that. I don't think Borthwick will mind too much if there's talk around that England are going to play a certain style. And if there are seeds in Gregor Townsend and his assistant coach's heads that, oh, England are going to start attacking from the halfway and deeper, I wouldn't read too much into it. I think they'll go up to Murrayfield with a tight tactical plan because Borthwick knows this game is about the win and the win only, because then they're 3 from 3 and then they look at the bigger, you know, but you know what I mean when I say the biggest challenge of all is Ireland, and they look at that in 2 weeks' time with another 2 weeks to prep. So for England, this is about getting the job done. This is not about making loads of friends up at Murrayfield. I think it's about winning, and I wouldn't be surprised if they go and they say to Finn, look, you can play all you like, but can you play from there? And George Ford is given, you know, license to kick the leather off the ball. I would not be surprised if he's going to do that whatsoever.
Weather update, light rain showers and a moderate breeze, average of 8 degrees Celsius. That's tropical, isn't it?
That's bammy. you take that in June and July. That's lovely. I think you've outlined it perfectly, Chris. I don't think Scotland are not expecting England to come and throw the ball around. They're expecting England to come and try and beat the lard out of Scotland physically. And, you know, we talk about Scotland's record, and I've talked about it. They've won 3 in a row. Winning margins, 5 points, 3 points, 6 points. So, you know, the game last year, it took one of the all-time great Scotland tries, and I'm not talking about Duane Vandermeer's first try, which was obviously a solo run from the gods.
Yeah.
The winning try was unbelievably good. It was incredible. Good. And it took that try to win the game. So if it follows recent season, it's going to be close. I still think Scotland will win because I think they're further down the line than England are. I think they're a better team than England are. I'm not expecting there to be much in it.
Yeah, and then if it is, as we've seen in these games, you know, I think the Scotland-France have been an extreme example because of the ending. It's toss of a coin stuff sometimes, isn't it? So we can sit here and prophesize and say, oh, that will mean that the game will pan out like this. But sometimes it simply does come down to something that is so, so fine. And, you know, England have come up the wrong side of a few scorelines in Calcutta Cup. Look, it's just a great one to call. It's so, so tough. And it's so good because you guys would have watched so many Calcuttas over the years. I remember going up to Murrayfield for one in 2014. Scotland didn't score a point. Scotland 0, England 20. Yeah.
That's right. God, that was grim.
Wow. And the pitch was a pudding, and there was talk about Scotland not being worth their place. And it's so great that this fixture, and I spoke about it a bit ago, it's jumped above England Wales in terms of the Jeopardy stakes, the excitement, the anticipation. It's got the plum slot in the middle weekend with a fallow week either side. And Gregor Townsend on the pod we did this morning was talking about it being a changed fixture on and off the pitch. On the pitch, because it's the games, they've opened up, you know, they've been hard to call, but Scotland have dominated in recent years and the rugby's been great. Real adverts for the game, adverts for the fixture. But off the field, he feels it's been a more positive, less vitriolic atmosphere. Maybe when Scotland's team wasn't up to much, the kind of anti-English sentiment was through the roof because that was the best way of getting under English skin. Now they know they can get under English skin by playing really, really good rugby, as they've shown time and time again. So both on and off the field, it's been a fixture transformed, I think, in the last 6 years.
Yeah. And like, you know, a rivalry is only a rivalry if the games are close and if it's not monopolized or dominated by one country over another. And it was for many, many years. And we talked up the Calcutta Cup, even though we knew England were going to win it. But we talked up, oh, you know, it's great, it's great. And actually, for quite a while, it wasn't great at all. It was very predictable. From a Scotland perspective, it was pretty depressing. But now it's great again. I think the Calcutta Cup is in as good a place as it's been in for many, many years. Maybe since the early 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that's thanks to Scotland. I mean, England were doing their thing. Scotland weren't doing their thing. Now Scotland are doing their stuff and they're winning games and they have almost saved the Calcutta Cup by getting their act together.
Yeah, and to repeat what you said and what you said a few weeks ago, Chris, I've come to the conclusion, yes, objectively, they are good fare in terms of matches. You, as a neutral, as an objective viewer, you can watch those games in recent history, well, for the past decade, and you are going to be entertained. And that's primarily what you want from a fixture in the Six Nations, isn't it? Because the beauty of the Six Nations 100%. Is that idea that most of our listeners will agree with this. You will have one team that you will support, and that means more than anything. But the real beauty of the Six Nations is watching the other two fixtures every weekend. So slotting in, basing your whole weekend around watching three games of rugby. And it's perfect because if you follow leagues, you're unlikely to be able to watch 10 fixtures in a weekend. Or even if you follow certain Welsh regions, three matches, four matches in a weekend is a lot to cover. But the absolute treat of the Six Nations is, you know, at certain points throughout the weekend, you'll be sitting down and watching those. And what we're telling you is that time and time again, this fixture delivers.
100%. 100%. Right. We will get on to predictions at the end and we'll come back to looking at the weekend as a whole. But time to get stuck in to Ireland against Wales. And what does that have in store? That's after this.
Exciting times, Ellis.
Oh, is it? Why?
Well, our brand new podcast is here. Two releases a week, and we get to leave behind the shackles of live radio and draconian vaping laws of Broadcasting House. Ellis, we are the pioneers of digital Britain, grasping the opportunity to redefine the audio landscape through powerful, impactful, dynamic conversation. You and I will inspire the next generation of free thinkers. What are your aims and aspirations for this new dawn?
I'll try to arrive on time and not eat mangone.
You know what? I'll take that.
The Ellis James and John Robbins podcast, out on Tuesdays and Fridays.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Okay, so Ireland against Wales. And there is a special pod coming Thursday morning with Sarah Shane-Hawke and Tom Shanklin looking at this rivalry, which really has been a rivalry over the course of the Six Nations. Not a historic traditional one going back centuries, like say in England, Scotland, or England, Wales, but a rivalry that's really, really grown and grown and grown. However, guys, and Tom used the phrase a rivalry is only a rivalry when it's close. Are we in danger of Ireland moving in one direction, Wales not moving in that same direction at the same speed? And actually, this is as predictable an Ireland-Wales game as we've had for some time. If we're saying that it's going to be hard to call Scotland, England, Scotland noses in front, maybe given their record, no one's backing Wales to win in Dublin. And that's not great for what has traditionally, or not traditionally, but recently been one of the great Six Nations games.
Shall I be the first witness for prosecution here, Chris? I'll try and do both sides, but I'll start with the easy job. which is convincing you that Ireland will win on the weekend. Ireland arguably are still the best.
You've convinced us already.
Exactly. Ireland arguably the best side in the world. The bookies have it at 23 points. Wales Ireland game with a 23 points.
Well, hold on. They won. Hold on. It was 29-7. So that's 22 points 2 years ago. And it was 34-10. But Ireland blew them out the gate in the first half. So it's been 27, 22 and 24 points. And you're saying it's what now?
23.
Yeah. I mean, it stands to reason on the recent last couple of games. But still,
that's an Ireland Wales game with a 23 point margin. Wales have quietly impressed in this competition so far, but if Wales hadn't played those two matches, you'd probably, looking at the team sheets, call like the day, you'd say, yes, that's a fair enough result. Big moment yesterday, or big moment on Sunday, when Dan Edwards kicked the drop goal for the Ospreys to defeat Ulster. That is the first victory for a Wales male rugby team against Ireland since 2022. Not a single Welsh team beat an Irish team in 2023. And I'm talking about regional or international level. And just look at the personnel. I was covering Scarlets against Munster on Friday night. Gavin Coombs would walk into the Wales team. Can't get anywhere near the Ireland squad. Thomas Ahern, who's just been called up, was outstanding. The depth is scary, and Wales are playing kids, and they're calling up Harry O'Connor, who's just joined the squad, who is a talented, fine young player, and he had an extremely difficult night on Friday night against this, not second string Munster pack, but a Munster pack that didn't have all its major artillery involved. So there we go. I rest my case. I struggle to see anything other than Ireland win.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't disagree. Ireland will probably be without Hugo Keenan. There's a little morsel of
games won by comfort games won by fullbacks.
Yeah, no. Hey, listen, I'm doing my best here. Hugo Keenan. I think of the last 30 big Six Nations Championship games, World Cup games, big games against Southern Hemisphere teams. He's played in starting 29 out of the 30. Unbelievable. Ireland's best player over the last couple of years, I would say. Looks like Kieran Frawley would probably go in at 15 there. Again, a very talented player, you know. So you're not putting a dud in there. He's a very talented player. I can't see beyond an Ireland win, and maybe it will be of that magnitude. And the thing here is, right, is, I don't know, the Wales rugby public are very demanding, even though the you know, at URC level, the results are poor. They're still quite demanding of their national team. Are they accepting that this is, properly accepting now, that this is a period of a rebuild and things might get pretty tough?
I think a year will be given to this squad. I mean, the media is in support of this agenda. This selection of Harry O'Connor is indicative of where Wales are going. And you have to, what am I going to go for? Give credit to Gatland? No, you have to admire his decision-making process. Now, it's been argued that Thomas Francis is unavailable. The same applies to Henry Thomas. Thomas Francis and Henry Thomas both playing in France. Could Wales have fought harder to keep them in Wales if desperately needed them, or even found a loophole to allow them to play? Wales have selected a tight head for the Six Nations. Kieran Azzarati, who had a cap before the Six Nations. Archie Griffin, who'd played 15 seconds for Bath in the Gaelic Premiership. And now they brought in Harry O'Connor. Three players who were nowhere near being proven at international level. Gatland has also picked Johan Lloyd, starting at 10. Not going for Owen Williams, or not just desperately trying his very best to get Jared Evans back, who'd suggested that maybe he had a loophole in his contract. So arguably, there's not credit in the bank, but those who understand rugby in Wales, and I think a large proportion of the Welsh public do, and they're quite knowledgeable in sport, will can look at the evidence and say, okay, this was the team that Wales had 2 years ago, and we recognise all these players. This is the team that Wales are putting out this week, and despite the fact that I regularly watch the URC, I still don't know who some of these guys are. So they're not stupid. Mm. They can at least go, right, okay, no wonder we're not winning. But how long could that... The other thing as well is, you know, what happens to ticket sales? Will they sell out Wales against Italy on the final weekend if they get absolutely thumped? And if ticket sales drop, commercial revenue drops, and that's what drives the game in Wales. But I think to answer your question, having gone round the houses, Tom, yes, I think the Welsh public understand where
but
they are right
for,
now.
For now, yeah. For now. But I think what's so special about Welsh rugby is, and you saw it firsthand at Twickenham, and you saw it in the second half in Cardiff against Scotland, and it's almost intangible, but you can just sense when a Welsh player starts playing with confidence, and they're just a completely different beast. And these young players, and we've seen it time and time again, they go into an international environment where they have a choice between sinking or swimming. Some of them sink, but some of them swim, and it's so incredible to see when someone who should not be equipped for that level, it should be too soon, they shouldn't be ready, they should be physically dominated, but they can hold their own because they grow in that jersey. That's what Gatland's banking on. I think we saw it at Twickenham, and they'll regret that because they had a chance, and it makes England still a hard team to analyse. We touched upon because they came back from 9 points down. They've done that very little in their international history, but it's against the Welsh team at home that, for all the reasons Gareth outlined, should have perhaps been put to the sword. But having said that about how impressive Wales were and how much their players grow in the jersey and how Gatland will find four or five diamonds in the rough this Six Nations, that is still not enough. It's not enough, is it? It's not enough in Dublin against that machine on that patch. And they've taken the Aviva to a place where I don't think it's ever been before in Irish rugby history, where it is almost impossible to see any team winning there, let alone a team that is so callow and has got players plucked from very, very few minutes of professional rugby, let alone regional or international rugby.
It could get really, really ugly for Wales on the weekend. It could do. And, you know, when you said 23 points grow, I was going to go, oh, wow. But actually, you know, it does make sense. That is logical. 23 points. It could be considerably more than 23 points if Ireland are as good as they have been. Wales have scored, I think, 70% of their points in this Six Nations against 14 men. So they've been effective when the opposition are down to 14. That's a slight concern that they've got 70% of their points, because going up against Ireland, and I looked at the cards stats, right? And we talk about Ireland and the cosmic nature of their rugby and the cohesion and the conveyor belt of talent and so many good things coming together. Their discipline is astonishing, right? So in their last 12 Six Nations games, two this season, five last season, five the season before, one yellow card in total in 12 games. France four.
Is that discipline, Tomro? Have they managed to convince through their consistency? They've a bit like the old All Blacks. They would get on the right side of a ref because they're almost reputationally. Or do you think they are just squeaky clean?
I don't think they're squeaky clean, but they're getting away with a lot. They're canny. They're experienced. You know, they're experienced, very, very, very experienced team, and maybe the aura counts for some of that, but I think they are a fairly clean team. One yellow card, like they've had four. If you go back to all test matches, going back to July 2022, when they had the three test series in New Zealand. So in the last 26 test matches, they've had four yellow cards in total. You look in the last 12, and this is a stat, I think it's worth mentioning, right? The last 12 Six Nations games, Ireland one yellow card. France, four yellow and two red. Italy, eight yellow, one red. Wales, six yellow. England, five yellow, two red. Scots, five yellow, one red. Like, it's astonishing how you can get through all these high-intensity games and have just one yellow card. Now, I'm sure there'd be fans of all nations going, hang on a second, they get away with murder. And fine, maybe they do get away with murder at times. But do you get away with murder for 2 years? You know? I just think it's a part of what Ireland are now. They are. You use the word, Chris, and I think it's the right word. They are a machine.
So I don't know, Gro. Where do we wrap Wales Ireland? Okay, they're going to be better for Twickenham. The players, you know, all those guys, they're going to be better for Twickenham, aren't they? They'll know they can mix it in some tough places.
Yes,
that's a start.
Yeah, and I was trying to scratch my head to think, if Wales pull off this win in Welsh rugby history, where does it lie in terms of level of shocks? And to be fair to Wales, they've gone into most matches in recent history as favourites or as sluggers with a good chance. So the obvious one that comes to your mind is 1999, when they spoiled England's party, Scott Gibbs' try, and you go, right, okay, there's your benchmark. Can Wales pull off the impossible doing that against Ireland, who are at a similar level to England? And then you look at the Wales team in 1999, and it's Quinnell to Gibbs with Neil Jenkins with the penalty. You know, I've only named three players there. That was not a bad Wales 15. This is a 15, yes. George North is one for the annals, but and Thomas Williams may well be in years to come. But right now, there aren't that many in that team who have a legacy behind them already. So,
with no Falata, with no Morgan, you know, you resam it, you put them in, and they might win at Twickenham. And, yeah, look.
But Wainwright's been class.
Wainwright's been brilliant. Yeah, they haven't. Yeah, those guys, they're going to have to get up the breakdown, try and break Ireland's flow. But it's just Ireland's relentlessness, which makes it hard to see a Wales win. But, you know, it's single swim time. They did a pretty good job of swimming at Twickenham. This is 2, 3, 4, 5 notches up. And you mentioned Rob Howley. That's a guy, I feel we need to mention Rob Howley because when we spoke about back foot number nines, and there were only a handful who could do what Antoine Dupont does and play off scrappy ball and manage to turn a negative into a positive, and I thought of Joost and Gareth Edwards. Rob Howley was one. How many times was he behind a beaten pack and he would somehow come up with something? He often gets overlooked. And it's kind of his career arc, his coaching comeback, and the fact he's back in the Welsh fold. There's a lovely article with him in the Sunday Times. That's been a bit overlooked. It's good to see him back. But as a player, I felt I needed to mention he was a back foot number nine who could make magic happen. What a player Rob Howley was.
Well, he had gas, didn't he? And I just want to add a bit of meat to that. Definitely, Chris. It's good to see him back. Obviously, he left under a cloud in 2019, betting scandal, and he was persona non grata for such a long time. Warren Gatland wanted to bring him back the first time around. Now, there are still some people who are extremely cruel and vitriolic about the demons that he faced. He did have a gambling addiction, and it's so good to see him back, especially when you compare him to a high profile Premier League footballer who's just come straight back from a gambling ban and is accepted with open arms because he is just scoring goals. Good on him in a way, fair play. But I just wanted to say, on a personal level, how good is it that we've accepted this person back and said, right, okay, yes, you did mess up. There was a justifiable reason behind it. And he is back. And hopefully, fingers crossed, he's doing a job for Wales as well.
And on the, there's a point Sam Warburton made when we spoke about wins at Twickenham. Two wins I can remember, Wales in Dublin, 08-12. Both with Grand Slam winning sides. It's something special to win in Dublin. Scotland have found that, haven't they, Tom? Over the years, it's been a bogey ground for them. So none of us can see it. For our predictions now, we'll start with Ireland-Wales. It's Ireland by a few, isn't it? I think we'll all go along with that.
Yeah, I think it's Ireland by... It could be Ireland by 30-plus. If they are as ruthless as they have been.
Ireland will win comfortably, and yeah, they will win at the canter, sadly.
Okay, let's save the Calcutta Cup for last. France against Italy. They're playing in Lille. Lyon for England. Marseille for Ireland. This is the kind of... this. we gave France a tough time after Marseille. Understandably so, they were whacked. But they beat Italy. They've had a break. Then they've got another break before going to Cardiff. And to Sean Edwards' influence, he won't let them go complacent to Cardiff, and you'd be mad too. They could still be going into the last day, and they'll need Ireland to slip up, of course, but with something to say about the championship, you know. But having said that, I think Italy will sense an opportunity too. They've pushed France close, particularly last year. I don't think playing in Lille will be anything like playing in Dublin for the Italians. So I think we're all probably in agreement France will win, but it's an intriguing game for sure. Not just to see how Italy go and whether we can almost see playing in Dublin these days as an anomaly. And this will give us a better idea of where Italy are, but also it will give us a good idea of where France are after getting out of jail in Edinburgh. Speaking about Scotland's psychology, France's psychology has to be, doesn't it? Got away with one there. Mm-hmm. Won the game we shouldn't have won. Let's make the most of this, win the next three, and finish the championship in pretty good fettle.
You go for it. You go for France, Tom, and I'll do Italy.
France were so bad against Scotland. And you're right, they got out of jail. That was the one positive for them. They won the match. They shouldn't have won it, but they did. They scored the try from Fiku in the first half, and then they had a five-minute spell from about the 70th minute when BLBRE scored the try. Scotland went to sleep. Then
so Tom, just pick you up on that. If they were so bad, mm-hmm. and you've spoken earlier in the pod about how good Scotland are, and France won away in Scotland, what does that say about either side?
I wouldn't say that Scotland were. I think Scotland are capable of being very good. They weren't very good against France. They should have won the match. They were the better team.
Do you think it was two teams playing below par?
Particularly the second half was an abomination. Sure. I mean, it was dreadful stuff. Scotland had the game under control, or some control, and they just went to sleep and they got suckered by 10 points in 5 minutes, and that led to the final act. But Scotland had a kicking game in the first half that worked. France were dropping the ball all over the place. They were just dreadful. Apart from the Fiku try, they created virtually nothing. And they looked a very, very average side. Their line-out went to pot again. Their power game didn't inflict much damage on Scotland at all, and that was one of the big concerns for Scotland going into the game. So I don't know where this France team is at. Now, I know they are missing, obviously, the greatness of Dupont and Entomac and Flemont and Jolange. They're missing a lot of big Aldrete players. Aldrete, yeah, I know. Wow, that France performance was week one and week two, even though they got away with it in week two. Very, very poor. So are they vulnerable against Italy? I don't know, Gro. Over to you. Italy, that was a bruising experience for them in Dublin.
Yes. Italy will be without Negri and Cannone, so they got a bit of a headache in the back row. Question mark for Italy is, and I revert back to the oldest cliche in sporting pre-match interviews, is that we've only concentrated on this game when I know for a fact that rugby coaches, once training finishes on captain's run day, they spend the rest of that Friday afternoon before a match on Saturday doing their analysis work in the week afterwards. So for Italy, if you've planned, and all coaches will, whatever they say about taking it week by week, all coaches will plan their tournament. If you're the Italian setup, what are the two games that you have the best opportunity of winning in this competition? And they are the last two. Scotland at home, only due to the fact that it's at home. Nothing to do with Scotland. I think they'd be saying the same if it was France at home. It's neither here nor there. And then the big one, Wales away from home, the wooden spoon to cider, potentially via. So what is their motivation for this game? How hard will they go in this match in Lille, or will they hold something back? And I mean that not necessarily in terms of attitude or determination, but just in terms of thinking, right, what is the hit out we're going to go all guns for? And it wouldn't surprise me if they've said it's going to be Cardiff in 3 weeks' time. Mm.
But then it's still about performance though, isn't it? You know, if they lose this game, they'll need to keep improving. They'll need to play well. They can't be blown away by France,
no,
and then expect to suddenly beat Scotland at home and Wales away. So I think Italy are in that place, and it's a constant story with Italian rugby for a variety of reasons, but It's a bit, you know, maybe where Steve Hansen was with Wales, and maybe Wales are there with some extent. You remember the slammed, was it in the 2000s, Doc Groh, when Nick Webb and Steve Hansen had a contretemps because Nick asked Steve Hansen, I know performance are important, but a win would be nice, wouldn't it, Steve? And he was like, no, it's about performance. And
I can't, you know, maybe there's something. I keep flipping telling you, mate.
And maybe there's something in that for, I think, for maybe Wales at the moment. But if performance keeps improving, the results will come as the players get more experience. And maybe Italy, even though they got that brilliant win against Wales 2 years ago, maybe they're still in that place as well. So I think we're all for a France win, but this carries a lot of intrigue. To your point earlier, Gro, about really enjoying the other games this weekend away from the one that maybe we're all covering. Yeah, that France-Italy, France, is can they turn this sort of wobble into, okay, let's get back on track. Italy at home with a fallow either side is a good place to do that. And Italy, yeah, maybe they are looking to finish the tournament super strong and target those two. And then predictions, a couple of minutes to go. Predictions for the Calcutta. Start with you, Gro. Where's your money?
What does Scotland, Tom expect
England,
you to say?
4:45.
I think you're going to say Scotland.
I am going to say Scotland. I am going to say Scotland. That's where the sensible money is. So Scotland, for me, to win at home against England for reasons I noted earlier.
Tom, you got Scotland, haven't you?
I'm going Scotland. Yeah, I just think they're a better team. I think it'll be close, though. I can't go through a Calcutta, and I haven't for many years, without mentioning my Calcutta Cup fact.
Oh, go on.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We heard there was a quiz on the way. Go on.
I tried. Well, I won't make it a quiz.
Make it a quiz. Go on.
Right. Okay. Okay. So there's one player. You'll never get the answer to this, right? So
will we never get the answer because we don't know who this person is? Or just
yes.
Oh,
right. Well, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, so, done this before. Go on.
So Quinton Dunlop, this is the person. Oh. So you've never heard of him, right?
Dunny.
Quinto, actually. Quinton Dunlop, Scottish hooker from 1971, won two caps for Scotland. Both against England, both victories, both in the same week. No. It was a 6 day or a Five Nations game. And then there was the RFU centenary game the following Saturday. He won both, started both, won both, and never played for Scotland again. How's your luck?
Tough gig. That's 100. That's a couple of hundreds on test debut and then binned off.
That's extraordinary.
I mean, he has reached that age. Is Quinton still with us?
I believe. Well, I interviewed him about 10 years ago.
You need to do it again. That is such a, that's a freebie, isn't it?
Isn't it amazing? And he was just the loveliest man. He was from around Ayrshire. He had an egg farm, I believe, from memory. And I met him at a hotel there, and he turned up with his scrapbooks and his jersey. The loveliest man, the proudest man ever to play for Scotland. He was so happy because he thought nobody remembered him. But I found him and I did a brilliant, he was such a charming man and so, so proud of his two cap. No wonder he's proud of his brief but spectacular
and Scotland his legend
career.
Lives on through the nation's pod.
Yes, it does.
Good stuff. Okay, right. I think that is us. Nation's pot in the can. By the way, my prediction for the Calcutta Cup is I'm going to go for, against my better judgment, because I hear what you've both said, and I think there's a very, very strong case for Scotland. But I will go for England just because, to mix it up. Also, it's a big one for England. It's a big one for Steve Borthwick. Big one, I think. They've been in camp for 5 weeks now. The talk of kind of we've not had a lot of time together as has been the message pre-Italy or post-Italy. I think that's not quite the state anymore. I think it's going to be a really, really tight one, and I'm going to back England by a score, but it could very much go either way, and that's why we love it so much, and that's why the Calcutta Cup, as we touched upon, is such an awesome fixture these days. Tom, I'll see you up there. Will you be dashing from Edinburgh to Stirling and vice versa?
Yes, absolutely. It's great. I can't listen. All these weekends are brilliant, but Scotland, England is just something extra, isn't it?
Well, Tom, I'll see you in Edinburgh. Grow, have a great one covering the Ireland-Wales game, which should be great. And just a word about our coverage to finish. Every game is on BBC Sounds. Scotland, England on 5 Live. The other two on Sports Extra. Uninterrupted coverage on Sports Extra from 2 until 5.30. We'll join the football, but all of it will be on 5 Live or Sports Extra. BBC Sounds will not miss a thing with us. BBC Scotland for the best coverage from Tom and the team. BBC Wales from growing the team. What a weekend it's going to be. More on the Daily tomorrow. We're inside the England camp with Ashi and Danny. 99 and counting for Danny. We'll speak to you then. Cheers.
Move out.
Pep Guardiola.
A perfectionist.
A tactical genius.
The best manager of his generation.
The best manager in history.
Reserve team coach Pep Guardiola, a popular former player at the new camp, will take over from Rijkaard.
This is a podcast all about the man who has shaped the modern game.
It feels almost as if he's solved the riddle, if he's cracked the code for football.
From his history in La Masia to dominating football across Europe.
He's brought a brand of football to the Premier League that we've never seen before.
Everybody plays like Pep's teams now.
From football, he takes you to heaven.
From BBC Five Life.
Sporting giants, Pep Guardiola.
Listen on BBC Sounds.